3 months on, could Syria slide back into civil war? In the Alawite bastion of ousted President Bashar al-Assad, the bloodiest week in years, attacks and revenge killings of civilians that the new masters of Damascus are scrambling to contain. Why did the Mediterranean coast region erupt? What triggered it? And what's the next move by the new strongman Mohammed al-Shara, the jihadist militia leader who's traded in his fatigues for a suit and promised the outside world justice and respect for minority rights? Enough for the West to begin a desperately needed easing of sanctions. Have the likes of the European Union moved too slowly or too fast in light of the events that we've seen since Thursday? And how does al-Shara navigate now between his own alliance of forces that include Turkey-backed militias, which contributed to the overthrow of Assad, but could pose a threat to the central authority in Damascus, the U.S.-backed Kurds who want federalism, and the Russians who want to keep their Mediterranean bases, not to mention Israel, which rejected overtures of détente for the moment and occupy more land in the Golan Heights than before? Today in the France 24 debate, can the new Syria keep it together? With us, Agyad Ghanem, lecturer at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Welcome to Syrian human rights activist Farah Youssef. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Zineb Ribua is program manager at the Hudson Institute's Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East. Thank you so much for being with us from Washington.
Thank you.
And from Norman, Oklahoma, we welcome back Joshua Landis, director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Oklahoma. Good to see you.
Pleasure being with you.
You can react on the hashtag F24Debate. Authorities insist that calm has returned to Western Syria. Social media awash, though, with graphic images that continue to come in and suggest otherwise. Some of it's been verified, like what we're about to show you. These images were actually published on Saturday. They show dead bodies in Latakia province. This, as the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports, that gunmen loyal to the new government stormed three villages then and indiscriminately killed all the men they came across. Enough to spark protests in the capital. Attorney Kerrigan has more.
Crowds gathered on Sunday in Damascus with placards that read "Stop the killing." After the country saw its worst violence since 13 years of civil war ended in December.
What we are calling for today is peace and stability in Syria, and also to stop any military escalation that might lead to deaths in the ranks of the security forces or the innocent civilians who are killed at the hands of undisciplined groups.
After a group of Assad loyalists ambushed a Syrian security forces patrol last Thursday in Jabal Latakia, Damascus sent backup to the region and launched a crackdown on so-called remnants of the Assad regime in the Latakia and Tartus regions. Militias loyal to the government appear to have joined the crackdown, which spiraled into an indiscriminate campaign of violence, killing mostly civilians from the Alawite minority. On Sunday, President al-Shara distanced his government from the violence.
We affirm that we will hold accountable, firmly and without leniency, anyone who's involved in the bloodshed of civilians, who overstep the powers of the state or who exploits their authority. No one will be above the law, and anyone whose hands are stained with the blood of Syrians will face justice sooner rather than later.
Calling the attacks on civilians and mistreatment of prisoners isolated incidents, al-Shara established a committee to investigate them. The Defence Ministry also announced on Monday they would be fully cooperating with the inquiry and that the operation against, quote, remnants of the Assad regime was over, an operation they qualified as successful. A United Nations delegation were in the region on Monday to investigate independently. These massacres come as Islamist rule in Damascus struggles to consolidate power in a country fragmented by ethnic and sectarian divides.
Before we go into why, Agyad Ghanem, what's the sense you're getting? Is it over, as stated by Damascus, or is there still violence?
There are still elements that show us from the ground that there are still situations of violence in several villages on the coastal parts of Syria. There are still villages being invested by these factions. There are still houses being burned, and there are still families hiding moving out from their villages and hiding, seeking for protection.
This Monday, I think these are incidents that you've seen this Monday, today.
Yeah, one may say that it was calmer today than yesterday, but it's not over. And the situation of angst and families hiding and sometimes moving even out, seeking refuge in Lebanon, it's a reality of today.
Farah Youssef, have you spoken to people inside Syria today?
Yes, and before I answer your question, if I may say, may the souls of those we've lost rest in peace, and my heartfelt condolences to their families and loved ones in these difficult days. My friends and people I have connections with on the grounds confirmed that even today, after the ceasefire was announced by the interim leader, we still have military violations being taking place on the ground.
And again, we're trying to piece together, first of all, why it started. Last Thursday, government forces tried to detain a wanted person near the coastal city of Jablay. They were ambushed by Assad loyalists. The atrocities that we described ensued. Here's what the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights had to say on Sunday.
The retaliatory operations are ongoing. Bombardments and burning of homes. The human losses are shocking, far greater than the number documented by the Syrian monitor. However, we are waiting to verify everything before publishing and updating the toll. We've seen video footage of fighters within the defense forces, not rogue militants, saying, Alawite dogs, we will force you out of your homes.
More than 1,000 killed. Joshua Landis, do we have a specific idea of why there was this ambush last Thursday and why the reaction was so swift and hard?
Well, this ambush that took place outside of Jablay in a town killed 11 regime soldiers. It was a bloody scene. We know that one of them was a high officer, had been in the military. The problem is that once that happened, there was a call put out for general marshalling of all people to come to the coast. And militias armed up the evening of the 7th, 6th and the 7th, and began pouring in big convoys. And the trouble in Syria is that Ahmed al-Sharaa does not control all these militias. There is a loose coalition. They came with telling their men to kill all the Alawite men and not to let any of them live. Abu Amsha, one of the major militia leaders, is recorded telling his people, you know, if you see an Alawite, kill him. If you see anybody with arms, kill him. And he goes on encouraging his men to do this. They came to the coast in big numbers and began this sort of paroxysm of violence. Three of my wife's cousins had their houses broken into, both in Banias and in Jablay. Everything was stolen. Their cars were taken. They were told to hand over the keys. And their jewelry, their phones, everything was taken. They're just lucky that they weren't killed. One cousin, who Haidura, who played with my son growing up on the coast, was shot, taken outside, and just summarily put a bullet in his head. Yesterday, up in the villages, as the violence began to stem in the cities, it only began to expand in the villages up in the mountains. And my brother-in-law spent the entire day hiding behind a rock. Two men from the village, the entire village, was hiding in the fields behind trees and rocks as armed men came into the city. And they searched for them with drones. And two of the men of the village were discovered and shot in the head. And things were stolen. And then they moved on to the next village. And this is what's been going on. Things got way carried away, very sectarian. The government, Ahmed Sharaa, didn't do anything. In fact, he called this general alarm, and it led to just thousands of people coming to the coast and carrying out what was really a pogrom right up and down the entire coast.
And our condolences go out to you and your family, Joshua. Did you Was there the sense that it was this much of a powder keg?
You know, tensions had been building up. There had been, you know, only minor cases of revenge killings. And the trouble is that the state has been tearing down the institutions of the old regime, the Assad regime, the military, the police corps, the police force, as well as not paying any of the salaries for the last 3 months and firing many people from government agencies. This has caused extreme distress. There's been constant provocations, a little back and forth, because there's no judiciary system. When Ahmed Shaddah says we're going to try everybody equally before the law, it makes your head reel, because there is no judiciary. The judges have been purged, and new judges have not been appointed. The chief justice that has been appointed, there's plenty of video of him executing women because of adultery, and they're being shot in the back of the head right there on the streets. This is not the kind of situation where you're going to get justice, unfortunately, because the institutions of the state have been dismantled and new ones have not been built yet.
Zineb Rabua, your thoughts on how it suddenly got so volatile?
Well, I think that while these clashes are very serious, I don't think they necessarily signal a full-scale return to civil war, at least not yet. If left unchecked and localized violence could spiral into a wider conflict, especially if external powers start backing different factions, then I think we should be very, very much worried, because let's not forget, this is a very sensitive time for Syria. It is a very diverse ethnically and culturally country, and we need to wait. But what I would say is that many seem to be missing the big picture. This isn't just about sporadic violence. The timing is really not a coincidence, because Turkey and Iran locked horns diplomatically with their foreign ministries summoning envoys over escalating tensions. Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan openly called out Iran's reliance on militias inside Syria. And they've been warning that Iran's policies were very dangerous and need to change. And his message was pretty blunt, that if Iran insists on destabilizing other countries, it shouldn't be surprised if others return the favor by supporting groups inside Iran itself. In short, I think that what we're seeing isn't just really a round of local bloodshed or sectarian violence. I think that this is really a symptom of a larger geopolitical shift, where Iran is increasingly on the defensive. Let's not forget that Syria served as a critical transit corridor for Hezbollah, Iran's most powerful proxy. Well, thanks to Israel, we don't have to deal with it now, but it is really important to keep in mind that for Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon are very important. So, and of course, we should wait to see the full investigation.
Yeah, let's take a look at the reactions of those two nations that are on opposite sides. We all recall at the start of last month, Mohammed al-Shara going to Ankara, part of his regional visits, Turkey, which today, as you say, stands by the new masters of Damascus. Let's listen to the foreign minister.
We have recently seen that the policy that the Syrian government has been pursuing for weeks without any provocation is trying to be derailed with provocations. Here, of course, it is important for all our brothers in Syria, whether they are Alawites, Christians, Druze or Nusayris, to stay away from all these provocations.
There is no justification for the attacks on parts of the Alawites, Christian, Druze and other minorities, which have truly wounded the emotions and conscience of both the countries of the region and internationally.
So different voices from Ankara and from Tehran. Zineb Rabua, just to be clear on your point, how much of this is the hand of outside players, or is it or is it just an atmosphere that made it possible for these massacres to occur?
I would say that we should wait and see, but it's very clear that Iran has always had these type of tactics in terms of sabotaging peace efforts, sabotaging the stabilization of countries. Let's not forget that Hamas was also the product of Iran seeing that Israel and Saudi Arabia were near a normalization agreement. So I think that the story here is really that pro-Assad factions might have had the signal from Tehran that they need to do something and destabilize any effort. I think this is a very important point to keep in mind.
I get Hanem. You agree?
I think it's one part of the story. Of course, the geopolitical situation is very central. The fact that many different countries of the area and all the regional powers of the area have contradictory interests in Syria, that's a fact. The fact that it's being very destabilizing for the country's peace now, and the fact that it was already destabilizing for the past 10 or 20 or 30 years, it's a fact as well, but it's only part of the story, because I think it's really also important to get back to the state of violence that we're being in Syria since December. And actually, it was the continuity of the state of violence that we had in the last years. You're talking about maybe getting back to a civil war. I don't really see what helped us moving out of it in the first place. Did we witness really processes of conciliation, processes of transitional justice from this new government? No, we didn't. We had only one day of national dialogue to discuss the 14 last years of war. It's not sufficient. Of course, it is not.
But they promised in that one day that it was just basically to set up committees that would then do the longer job
but
of discussing.
It should have been a priority. It should have been the number one priority. Otherwise, how can you stop the most radical factions that Joshua just mentioned from showing their own vision of transitional justice, which is abusive, which is arbitrary? I have dozens of examples from the coastal parts of Syria, and other colleagues have examples from the Homs area of these transitional justice practices. So you would have an operation against a criminal from the Assad regime, and of course we need to arrest criminals from the Assad regime, but in the framework of many of these operations, abuses were committed against civilians, and these were what are called now for months individual cases. And this show maybe the minimization of such tensions and such sectarian tension by the new government that didn't show until now the will to densely answer this issue.
Would it have been unrealistic? I'll put it to you, Farah Youssef. When Assad fell on December the 8th, was anybody expecting a nation that had gone through more than half a century of dictatorship, of family-run dictatorship, would suddenly have a working judiciary system?
I mean, we didn't, but we had many chances. We had so many.
It's only been 3 months.
Yes, but in these 3 months, everything has been going wrong. I would like to build on what Ariad said. We can talk about external factors. We can talk a lot about that, but we need to focus on internal interim governance dynamics. There are two cornerstones for our transition to sustainable peace in Syria, and they have both been extremely neglected. We have transitional justice and we have DDR. We have disarmament, demobilization and reintegration of combatants in Syria. These two topics in Syria have been extremely neglected, and the authority tested us in Homs. These atrocities haven't started in last Thursday. They committed violations, sectarian violations in Homs. They tested the Syrian community and the international community. We saw military groups asking Syrians to bark just because they're Alawites. We saw thefts. We saw, I mean, abductions. People were abducted. People were imprisoned just because they were Alawites. And then the Syrian civil society is trying to mobilize itself to help the new leadership run this very sensitive time for Syria, and they're refusing, they're centralizing power, and they're refusing to let any stakeholders take their part in rebuilding civil peace.
So it's not being inclusive enough?
It's not at all inclusive.
So there is a piece of breaking news, and I want your reaction to it. Syria's central government putting out a statement saying it has reached a deal with the Kurdish-led authority that controls the northeast, including a ceasefire and the merging of the main U.S.-backed force there into the Syrian army. I'll read you what it says, because this is kind of important. It says it was signed between the interim president and Mazlum Abdi, the commander of the U.S.-backed SDF. And under this deal, by the end of the year, border crossings would be under Damascus's command. In exchange, Syria's Kurds will gain the rights, including teaching and using their language, which was banned for decades under Assad. So there is partially this point made to the point that Zineb made earlier, this idea. It's not full-scale civil war, since there is this deal ostensibly that's been reached. Your reaction to that,
team? It's not a full-scale civil war, that's for sure. And we still have the time to put a lid on everything that's happening. It's a matter of political will. Do we want to put an end to this, or do we just want to centralize power and hog all authorities? Now, what you're saying is very unexpected for me, but again, this morning I was reading what Musa Omar was saying, and he's a journalist that is very close to the new leadership in Syria, to the interim leadership. He was saying what's happening in the coast is a message to the Kurds, and is a message to the south of Syria, to Druze and to Daraa. So if we want to build civil peace on terror, we want to terrorize people to come to Damascus, that's not going to be sustainable. The Kurds were excluded from the dialogue conference they held in Damascus, and they have been excluded from many initiatives that Damascus has been taking since 8th of December. And I'm not sure if anyone today is willing to hand over their arms and to join Damascus willingly after what we've seen, both in Homs and in the coast.
Joshua Landis, I'm not very good at multitasking, so I can't have a debate and look at dispatches at the same time. So I haven't seen yet a confirmation from the Kurdish side that this deal has in fact been signed. But if it has, what's your reaction?
Well, these are little partial deals. What the Kurds want is local autonomy and to police themselves. The Druze in the south, about 3% of the Syrian population, the Druze Mountains, another minority, want the same thing. They have been unwilling to give up their guns to Damascus, as is demanded by Damascus, and want their own autonomy. Now, Israel has said that no Syrian troops can be deployed south of Damascus. This is a big hunk of Syria, and it includes the Druze Mountains. So the Druze have big negotiating power now. Even though they have rejected Israeli intervention, they can use it because Damascus can't attack them. And the Kurds, after this, you know, after what's happened on the coast, I was talking to one of the Kurdish leaders in Washington that represents the autonomous zone yesterday, and she said, you know, if Ahmed Sharaa is trying to send us a message, this is the wrong message, because we do not trust him. We don't believe that if his forces take charge of the Kurdish region, that they won't do the same thing to us that they've done to the Alawites. So I think the Kurds are going to resist giving up their arms. Now, of course, that depends a great deal on Washington, because the U.S. has 2,000 troops there. It's a no-fly zone. It's the U.S. that largely protects the Kurds. And the big question is, will the U.S. withdraw? Trump has said he wanted to a long time ago, but we saw the State Department today or yesterday or a few days ago say we stand with Syria's minorities, the Kurds, the Alawites, the Christians, the Druze, and that this is unacceptable. Israel has also offered to help the Kurds and has said that Sharaa's government is barbaric and this proves that they're terrorists and so forth. So Sharaa has been undertaking a real campaign to try to woo the West. And he has gotten Europe on his side, and Europe has dropped many of its sanctions. But the United States has not. And the Trump administration, Israel, look like they're going to keep sanctions on for the foreseeable future. And this last violent, sort of putting down of Alawites indiscriminately, I think is going to damage Shadow's reputation and his government's efforts to, in this sort of charm campaign with the West. Arab governments have stood by him through this and say this is all about Iran, but it's not about Iran. This is about internal sectarianism in Syria, and trying to find some sort of justice and participation for all elements, and protection, really, is protection for Syrians, so that they won't go through this kind of thing. And it's made all Syrians much more frightened about their future.
Zineb Ribou, are you seeing any confirmation from the Kurdish side that this deal has been signed in the wake of the massacre of these minorities?
I have not seen that yet, but what I can say is that I think a week ago, the Kurdish leader, Abdullah Öcalan, he called on his militants to disarm, the PKK to disarm and to make peace with Turkey. And I think that was a big signal. I think it's a historic achievement in the sense that if Turkey had one priority, making sure that a Kurdish state does not happen on its borders was really key. And I think that's something Erdogan paid very much attention to. So I think we see progress on that side, especially because, you know, Kurds are very important for have always played a big role in Syria, and in Syria's not just cultural life but also political life, and making sure that they are represented, have some sort of autonomous, maybe a federal system. We don't know yet. But making sure that they live in peace, like other minorities, like the Druze and others, is and should be a priority.
And do you agree with Joshua Landis that the United States, unlike when Donald Trump tried when he was first president to walk away from having troops inside of Syria protecting the Kurdish forces, that this time it looks like this Trump administration, Zineb, is going to stick around?
You know, we really don't know.
It's a question. It's a question for Zineb Ribua. Sorry.
Sorry. You mean that it means that Trump will stay in Syria?
Yes.
Well, I don't think so. I think that that withdrawal from Syria is really something that Trump tried to do in his first term. And this time it looks like there is maybe a way to do it. And one of them is to forge a good relationship, an agreement, an accommodation between Turkey and Israel so that Israel feels protected and when it comes to its borders, and Turkey feels the same way. I think that an exit this time is possible, given that that Turkey is there. I think that it's also possible this time, since the United States can enforce strict conditions to ensure the stability of Syria. One of them is to make sure that there is zero tolerance for terrorism, no weapons of mass destruction, no American hostages, and so on. And I think the United States has the ability to withdraw this time.
All right. In his interview with Reuters earlier, Mohammed al-Shara dismissing as nonsense Israeli claims that Syria is a threat, Israel, which Sunday published images of its new chief of staff, Eyal Zamir, in an undisclosed location inside of Syrian territory. Joshua Landis, you heard Zineb say that a lot of this hinges on whether or not Israel and Turkey can come to some kind of agreement. Is that possible when it comes to Syria?
Israel has made a strong case that Turkey is perhaps worse than Iran, and that Turkey is now on Israel's border. That's the argument that Israel is making, and that Turkey supports this shutout government, which they see is still made up of terrorists. That's what the foreign minister called them not long ago. So I don't see Israel and Turkey getting along on this issue or putting aside their enmity. I think that that's probably going to grow because Israel is pursuing a policy to keep Ahmed Shattah very weak and keep Israel divided, and is encouraging the United States to maintain their position in Syria. So Turkey and the and Israel are pursuing very diametrically opposed strategies. Turkey wants America out and wants the Kurds under the Syrian central government. Israel has said that they will protect, that they support the Kurds in their demand for autonomy, and they have been supporting, of course, the Druze in the south, which gives strength to this call for a federal form of government, which the minorities are calling for. And so I see these two clashing, and it could very well be that America gets stuck in Syria for some time to come.
Agyad Ghanem, what does your crystal ball tell you?
I think it's, again, the most important challenges for Ahmed al-Shattah right now is about civil peace. It's about managing to foster a dynamics of conciliation after such dynamics of conflict had erupted. I kind of agree with Joshua with the fact that the regional powers' role in Syria for now has been really destabilizing because the different powers support different sides.
Yeah, the Israelis saying they're encroaching in the name of protecting the Druze minority.
Yes, exactly. And Turkey is a very close ally of Ahmed al-Shattah. And I think what is interesting in this agreement that you just mentioned with the Kurdish movements, the FDS, it's that it looks like quite advantageous to the Kurdish side because these, what you mentioned in terms of autonomy, cultural autonomy, and keeping their own police, it was the core claims of the movement, which maybe shows that it's also the result of Ahmed al-Shattah being weakened by what just happened and wanting to show that he's able to build new coalitions and that he's able to be inclusive, since he's not being able to do so with the Druze south and the Alawites west. He maybe, if this is confirmed, managed to show some kind of conciliation with the Kurdish movements.
When you say weakened, what do you mean?
I mean that his very important narrative when he arrived as someone who inherited the Al-Qaeda section, the Nusra Front in Syria, and who was the leader of the Nusra Front in Syria for years, and as someone who was telling the West that he had now adopted a more moderate position and that he was able to create this kind of inclusive government in Syria and to foster the participation of all parts of the people. That was his narrative, and that's the narrative that he used in order to negotiate with the left and lift the sanctions. Joshua said that he managed to lift some of the sanctions, but many other are remaining now, and now he's not. He may have showed the limits of his speech and of his narrative, because what we are seeing on the ground in the past few days and weeks, it shows that he was not able to be inclusive. He was supposed to name a new government 10 days ago that was supposed to be inclusive and represent all the diversity of Syria. He didn't. And I think he didn't for two reasons. Because maybe he's struggling to find people to work with him. That's the first question, with the past that he has and the reputation that he's trying to build, but that still inherits the past steps of his path. And the other issue is maybe he's not trusting most of the parts of the Syrian people, the moderate parts of the Syrian people, the minorities in Syria. So whenever he's saying, I want to be inclusive, in the end he ends up appointing people from his city, and sometimes from his family and relatives at the highest positions in Syria.
So at this point, Farah Youssef, two questions. First of all, what do your contacts back in Syria tell you? Do they see, just to finish on this question of geopolitics, do they see al-Shara as Turkey's man?
Actually, people were optimistic in the first month. They were buying this rebranding, but each day he's losing his popularity, especially among minorities. And in the two speeches he made in the past 2-3 days, he mentioned the rule of law, and he also mentioned forming an investigation committee that's going to bring people who committed these atrocities and these massacres to the justice. But then, what law? We don't even have a constitutional declaration in Syria. We don't know what law he's talking about. And then when you talk about an agreement with the Kurds, I mean, what are the guarantees? We have no guarantees in Syria. Whenever he makes a speech, he says somehow positive things, and then when we come to implementation on the ground, we see nothing. So my relatives are not optimistic, to be honest.
Not optimistic, and this question of whether or not he's weakened, your reaction to that?
I think he is weakened. I mean, we've seen Trump's reaction and the French reactions also, and the France was one of his biggest supporters since December, and they helped him lift sanctions, European sanctions, and now they're turning because of what has happened in the past few days. But he still has the chance to turn this thing upside down. He has the chance to admit that he cannot rule the country alone. He does not have the expertise, he does not have the capacity to run a post-conflict country, to govern Syria in this, at this stage. Everything is tied to his rebranding.
But if he broadens his coalition, you heard Joshua Landis earlier describe some of the heavies inside of his cabinet. That means basically casting aside those heavies. Can he do that?
I don't think anything can be done in Syria if we do not move towards actual democratic transition. It's not about wearing a costume and an expensive watch. He needs to adopt democratic values. He needs to adopt human rights, and he needs to allow other stakeholders and other Syrian expertise take turn and take place in governing the country. I'm not only talking about Syrian civil society. I'm also talking about local councils. I'm talking about political parties, about defected officers. I mean, how did he do a military operation without having safe passages for civilians? We didn't see safe passages. We didn't see Red Crescent. We didn't see civil defense and comprehensive war reporting during these operations. I mean, if this is something he didn't know that he should have done, then that's a problem. And if he knew that that this is not how we operate, I mean, some people say this is war. These were casualties. These were not casualties. These were massacres, and they could have been prevented. We could be in a much better place if he just accepts that democratic transition in Syria is a must.
I want to talk about the challenges he faces. We've talked about the internal pressures, the external pressures. At the beginning of the conversation, Iran sidelined by the fall of Assad. Russia as well, to a degree. Moscow still retains control of the Hmeymim air base and the Tartus naval base. It's Moscow's only warm water port. It's been keeping the channels open with al-Shara, who last month spoke by phone with Vladimir Putin, and at the end of January welcomed the Russian deputy foreign minister to Damascus. Now, in a sign of steadily improving ties, the Reuters news agency last week reporting that a new shipment of its local currency, printed in Russia, because that was the deal under Assad, did arrive on Wednesday, and more shipments were expected in the future. That's a sign of improving ties between Moscow and Syria's new rulers. So you talked earlier, Zineb Ribua, about Iran, of course, being sidelined with the fall of Assad, but Moscow finding a way back in. And that brings us back to this thorny question of whether or not you ease or not the sanctions if you're a Western capital.
Yes, so I believe that this has really to do with the struggle in Ukraine and the Black Sea. Let's not forget that Turkey's stance on Ukraine has been pretty clear, which includes backing peacekeeping efforts in the region, endorsing Ukraine's NATO membership, and Russia's position in the Black Sea can become dominant, especially if Moscow's growing influence keep on rising. And this is where I think Syria comes into play. I think Turkey recognizes the strategic value of Russia's military infrastructure because it might need to leverage in the future these...
So when you see Moscow getting back slowly, perhaps, into Damascus's good graces, what do you do if you're in Paris or Washington? Do you ease sanctions or not?
On Shara, I think that it's possible to put a clear condition that no foreign power should be allowed to have a military base and so on. But this will only happen if Washington puts also pressure on Russia in the Black Sea.
Joshua Landis?
You know, I think Russia is going to come back to Syria. Russia has already sent several tankers of oil to Syria, which it values very much. It's sent this currency. It's in negotiations with Shara. And Russia is very eager to woo this government and to maintain its bases. The head of the Senate Foreign Foreign Relations Committee in the United States just the other day said that they would not lift sanctions if Russia remained in Syria. But Russia is remaining in Syria. My main base is open, and thousands of Syrian Alawites went and took refuge in the base. They were allowed into the base by the Russians in order to protect themselves from these massacres just recently. So Russia is playing a game of trying to woo this government and remain in Syria. And the United States, it doesn't want that to happen. But at the same time, they're not going to offer any consolation to the Syrian regime. I think they're going to keep on sanctions. And Israel has actually lobbied Washington to allow the Russians to come back in as a counter to Turkey. Israel argued that they don't want Damascus to be too dependent on the Turkish army. So they would like Russia to maintain some bases on the coast, and this would allow Shara to, in a sense, play the two off against each other and keep a modicum of independence from the Turks. So there are many different agendas being pushed on Washington, and we'll have to see which way Washington will go, whether it'll ultimately accept that the Russians stay there or whether it will continue with sanctions in order to try to force them out.
We're almost out of time. Ariad Hanem, what do you do if you're in Paris or Washington now regarding Damascus?
What do you do?
Do you ease sanctions or tighten them?
That's a very, very tough question. The question of sanctions in general. I mean, the first people who are suffering from the sanctions, it's the Syrian people. They are still being in a very hard economic situation. The people working in the public services, they haven't been paid in the last month. We still have a very, very hard situation paying people, guaranteeing electricity, water in many parts of Syria. So is it harming the people or is it harming the government? That's a very tough question. Another example that I would like to give is that maybe sometimes the sanctions, it can help a leadership, a certain power, to strengthen its position within an isolated system. For example, on the coastal part of Syria, which is the one I know the best, the one my family comes from, the new government, they chose which charities and associations should benefit from public funds and which ones shouldn't. And they did that in a quite arbitrary way. So many associations that were working for the people, they can't have fundings anymore. And because of the sanctions, We cannot help such associations. So you see, are you helping a transition, or are you just putting a whole population in a situation of isolation with all the dramatic implications that it can have?
It's a story, of course, we'll continue to follow as it continues to develop. Hayat Ghanem, I want to thank you. I want to thank as well Farah Youssef, Zineb Rubua for being with us from Washington, Joshua Landis from Norman, Oklahoma. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.